Anna is Anna Robertson. Anna is an experienced practitioner. She's been at the bar about 8 years and a solicitor about 8 years before that. So she has broad experience in the area of ethics and mediation, or ethics in mediation, I guess it might be more accurately described, through her practice as a barrister, and through also presenting on the topic for groups such as this group. Anna's practice is a commercial practice. It includes professional negligence. She's acted on behalf of solicitors who have had professional negligence and disciplinary issues in their practices. So at a practical level, she also comes across this topic. As a solicitor, Anna was a senior associate with Cody's, and she also worked with Norton Rose in London. So she brings a breadth of talent and experience to us this morning. Please welcome Anna Robertson.
Thank you, Michael. Okay, so we're going to try and all wake up and deal with ethics, which I know is a topic which is one of the compulsory units, and so we'll try and make it as interesting as we can. Mediation is an area which most people in the room will at some point have had some involvement with. Whether you're a litigator or not a litigator, you will have come across mediation, I'm sure. And there are obviously ethical issues which arise in any form of litigation, but equally in mediation circumstances. So what I thought I'd do this morning is start off by talking to you generally about ethics and to give you an overview of some of the ways that people can approach ethical decision making. And I want to do that because what I've noticed when you do talk to people about mediation is people approach the way they negotiate from very different positions. And so it's always helpful just to have a recap on what the types of approaches that you can take towards making ethical decisions. So first of all, there are many possible ways that you can look at it. You can look at making a decision on the basis that something is right. That is, if you like, whether the actions are the right actions to do. Or you can look at it and say, does the action produce the greatest good for the most people? An example of that might be where you have, for instance, a mediation or a case where there's a family law dispute, but there are children involved. The children may not, for instance, be parties to the mediation, but you may be looking for a result that will achieve the greatest good for the greatest number of people, including the children. So that would be an example of that. You can approach ethical decision-making by looking at what's good and what's bad, and we'll come to that in a moment. But there are some situations where you have an inherent sense that what is being proposed isn't right, and so some people will approach decision-making on the basis of whether it's good or bad. Everything that you do will be a tussle between outcomes versus process. Some people will approach decision making on the basis of whether the outcome is ultimately going to be a good outcome for their client. Other people, however, will say, well, has this process been fair? If the process is fair, then I'm okay with the outcome, even though it may not be completely in my client's favour. There are also situations where you have to ask yourselves, despite those two possible methods of decision making, what would a good lawyer do in this situation? And the fourth possible way is to look at it and say, well, what would be the morally correct thing to do? There's no specific right or wrong way to approach ethical decision making. I'm just highlighting for you some of the different ways so that when you are opposed to people, you can perhaps understand the way they might be coming at a decision in a mediation so that you can perhaps talk to them on the same level. So to demonstrate some of these issues, I thought we'd look at the James Hardie case, which most of you will be familiar with from media reports at the time, but it is a useful case, so I thought we'd start off by looking at that. So I've just got some questions there and I'll take you through the case, but they're the sorts of things that just bear in mind as we think about the case. How did it make the public feel? Why? And what ethical issues does it raise? James Hardie was a company which manufactured asbestos, and in 1977 it had its first claims made against it. By 1987 it had ceased manufacturing asbestos and claims continued to come in. By 2001, there were a significant number of claims which had been made against the company, and James Hardie sought to restructure the group so that the liabilities would be vested in a new entity. And what they proposed to do was to set up a foundation where they would pay money to a trustee company who would then fund the foundation. And that's in fact what happened. The foundation received $300 million from James Hardie for research, and it was set up to manage the claims of the asbestos victims. That decision to set up the foundation and the amount of money that was to be paid into it was made on the basis of an actuarial report known as the Trowbridge Report. And what that report did was it set out what it, the actuaries, thought would be the future anticipated liabilities that James Hardie would incur. However, the Trowbridge Report was incredibly out of date, and the figures were in fact not correct. And claims continued to come in, and so the projections for future liabilities then were well out of date and incorrect. And this is where we come to the crux of it. James Hardie's in-house counsel was aware of the inaccuracies, but he didn't tell the board. That's the first point. The second point is that they had external legal advisers, Allens, who were advising them in relation to the transaction. There was a solicitor within Allens who did raise some concerns about the report, but the CEO and the chief in-house counsel basically said, well, don't worry about that. The foundation is going to be adequately funded and it's not a problem. And so Allen's concerns ultimately were removed from the advice that went to the board. So nowhere along the line have either the in-house counsel or the external advisers informed the board that the actuarial report is out of date. By February 2001, James Hardie had issued a press release stating that the foundation had sufficient funds to meet future asbestos claims. And between February and October 2001, the directors of the foundation realised that there would in fact be a shortfall in the funds and requested James Hardie to do something about it. So up until that point, they'd been unaware that there had been a deficiency in the funds within the foundation. And as soon as they became aware of it, they've said to James Hardie, look, you're going to have to do something about it. We need some more money. Allens advised James Hardie that the foundation at that point had no compensable claim against it and suggested instead that the assets of James Hardie be transferred to a parent company in the Netherlands. And that left then a shelf company within Australia with about $20 million worth of assets, as you can see, incredibly below what would be needed to fund the liabilities of James Hardie. James Hardie issued partly paid shares to the Netherlands parent company, which allowed them to draw up to $1.85 billion. However, the possibility that the partly paid shares might be cancelled was not discussed at that time. Now, I stop there and I say query that because it probably was within the contemplation of those setting up this scheme, including the lawyers. We can't say for sure, but it probably was within their contemplation that shares might be the partly paid shares might be capable of being cancelled. The James Hardie restructure then had to be approved by the Supreme Court in New South Wales. And when the lawyers went before the court, they told the court that the $20 million plus the $1.85 billion accessible from the Netherlands parent company would be available to the foundation to meet the asbestos liabilities. The court was not told, for instance, about the solvency concerns about the foundation, which at that point had a limited amount of $300 million, which was being rapidly depleted. The court was not told that the partly paid shares may be cancelled, and the court then approved the restructure. Throughout all of this process, they had the in-house lawyers advising, they also had Allens advising. In October 2001, James Hardie sought advice about whether it could cancel the partly paid shares from Allens. And at that point, Allens said, no, look, it's a bit soon. We better not do it yet. It might be seen in the wrong light. But by 15th of March 2003, James Hardie made the decision that it could, in fact, cancel the partly paid shares, and that was what it did. At that point, the Netherlands company no longer had a liability to fund the foundation. And so James Hardie had no ability to fund the compensation foundation. So I'll just stop at that point. There's a number of issues which come out of that case, but many of you will remember at the time the public outrage that sprung from that case. There were mass media coverage of the circumstances of the case, and people felt a genuine sense of outrage and injustice towards the asbestos victims who were going to effectively be shut out of making their claims. So we then look at why that was. Why do people feel that sense of outrage? Well, there was the injustice to the victims. First of all, they weren't going to receive the amounts in compensation that they might otherwise have received. There was another sense of outrage, certainly between and amongst lawyers, I think, who would have felt that no one saw fit to raise the ethical issues of what was being done. We have lawyers here who have duties to clients, to the court, but also overriding moral duties, perhaps, to raise concerns like this. And I think that was another area where people felt a genuine sense of outrage. Another thing was that the lawyers must have been involved in devising and were in fact involved in devising the scheme. So it wasn't just a case of lawyers sitting by and doing nothing. They were actively involved in the scheme that was set up. And it certainly when it came before the court, there is also the question of the lawyers not being frank about what they were doing. So it raises ethical issues about how you advise your client, what in-house lawyers should do. Are in-house lawyers just another cog in the machinery of the business world? Are they there to do the bidding of the business that they are employed by, or are they really independent? And the question is, well, of course they must be independent, and I think James Hardy clearly illustrates why they must be independent. And it shows that there was this very clear loss of independence by the lawyers. Another thing that the case raises is the overriding public duty to shareholders. We have, on the one hand, lawyers here trying to do what they should on behalf of an employer, be it right or not right, in my view, not right. There's another separate question about, well, to what extent should lawyers be trying to increase shareholder wealth at the expense of the public? So all of these issues, I think, feed into why the public felt such a sense of outrage about it. There's also the question about whether the lawyers misled the court in the New South Wales Supreme Court, and the general sense of the public pressure, the media pressure, for the lawyers and everyone in this type of situation to do the right thing. So with that background, I'm going to now move to talk to you about mediation, because I think it does raise some of the issues that might come up. And before I do, I will just quickly mention some of the other things that do come up within cases that you may come across, and which will, I think, become more and more important as of 1 January 2011, when the Civil Procedure Act commences operation. Factors like delay and unnecessary interlocutory applications. The Guns and Maher litigation is an example of where those types of factors were severely criticised by the judge, and you'll see at page 7 of the paper I've extracted a quote from Justice Bongiorno in that case, where he basically says, look, the parties had to grapple with too much and it was too big a case, and the solicitors shouldn't have been issuing documents that required particulars to a further 2,000 or so paragraphs, I think he refers to. And one of the problems with the Guns litigation was you had a large corporate entity opposed to very small individuals who had very, very limited resources, and it was incredibly difficult for them to fight the type of case that Guns was putting forward on the resources that they had. And so you might query, well, is it ethical for lawyers to commence litigation knowing that the other party is going to be put in a position where they just simply can't fund it? Is that ethically a good thing for lawyers to do? So is mediation about fairness? That's a question that you might ask yourselves. We have a mediator who is supposed to be neutral, impartial, and we have the two solicitors with competing views that they're putting forward for their clients. Whether mediation is about fairness, I think, depends on which ethical model you look at to analyse what happens within a mediation. Are you focused on the outcome? Are you focused on the process? Whether their decisions are being made on a moral basis or whether you're looking at the greater good for the greatest number of people. What is clear is that in many mediations and for many reasons, there are power imbalances. There may be unrepresented parties, for instance. There may be situations where parties, for whatever reason, are under some form of power imbalance. For instance, things like domestic violence situations, or there may have been physical threats made to one or other of the parties to a proceeding. Those are situations where there can be power imbalances and which mediators need to be very careful about. What should a mediator do in that situation? Should they intervene? Should they take steps to advise, for instance, unrepresented parties? Should they consider whether outcomes are going to be morally right or whether they're unjust or wrong? These are the types of questions that face mediators every day. So let's look then at lawyers when they do act as mediators. As I've said, the main issues which will face mediators are whether they are required to act fairly, whether they are required to act impartially. There will, of course, as every client would expect in a mediation situation, be an obligation of confidentiality imposed upon a mediator. The question will become, well, what does that obligation require? And we'll look at that. Many mediations, in fact, most these days, will have an agreement which has been drafted by the mediator, which the parties then are required to sign. And that will set out most of the obligations that the parties will be required to adhere to in the course of the mediation and following on from the mediation. It will also usually set out what the mediator will be required to do. The mediator, for instance, there may be provisions there requiring that the parties not subpoena the mediator to give evidence. There usually will be provisions which will require the mediator to keep information confidential and also the parties. I've also then referred to the Civil Procedure Act and in particular Section 34, where each party involved in a civil dispute will be required to take reasonable steps to resolve the dispute. And this particularly will relate to pre-litigation steps as well as the course of the litigation. If you read the Act, it doesn't specifically refer in the pre-litigation steps to a requirement for parties to have undertaken mediation, but they have to have undergone some form of genuine attempt to try and resolve the dispute, whether it be exchanging documents and correspondence about something, some form of alternative dispute resolution. The general feeling amongst people is that one very clear way of showing to a court that you have complied with that obligation will be to show them or to tell the court that the parties have engaged in mediation or alternative dispute resolution. So for the purposes of mediators, that then raises questions because the mediator will be acting in a situation where proceedings have not been commenced and there will be no court orders, for instance, that mediation occur. Many of you probably are already involved in mediations prior to the commencement of litigation, and these issues won't necessarily be unfamiliar to you, but I think they're highlighted by the Act because clients will have to, if they choose to enter into a mediation, be able to satisfy the court that they've done that, and the mediator will have to also be aware of what his obligations or her obligations are. Does the mediator have a duty to advise the parties? So, for instance, if you have a situation where one of the parties is unrepresented, everyone will be familiar with clients who, for one reason or another, are unrepresented, and parties who are unrepresented. And no doubt these parties do ask the mediator questions in the course of a mediation. What should the mediator do? Is the mediator required to advise them? Well, Practice Standard 2.7 of the National Mediator Accreditation, Australian National Mediator Standards, says that they can only advise if they're specifically requested to do so. But it should be, the mediator should be very careful because the parties may have made some agreement to that effect in the mediation agreement, and absent agreement from the parties, the mediator must not advise, and that's Tapui and Leuenberg. I must say, there's not very many cases which deal with mediation, because generally speaking, mediators have clauses in their agreement which require the parties not to call them to give evidence and not to subpoena them. So Tapui and Leuenberg is a relatively recent case which says that absent agreement, mediators must not advise. So the professional conduct rules for solicitors, which you'll need to consider. Mediators are in a very different situation to solicitors advising parties. Obviously, rules about confidentiality with respect to advice given to clients won't apply to a mediator because they are said to apply specifically to clients. But Rule 21, which deals with the integrity and reputation of the legal profession, is, I think, an overarching requirement that will have effect for a mediator. And you can see there that practitioners, when they're dealing with other practitioners, must take reasonable care to maintain the integrity and reputation of the legal profession by ensuring that the practitioner's communications are courteous and that the practitioner avoids offensive or provocative language or conduct. Arguably common sense, but you do from time to time see solicitors who take things one step too far, barristers too, and don't always remain courteous, and there can at times, it tends more to be clients, be provocative language or conduct. But it's a very broad catch-all provision, and there are a number of things that you could possibly think of that might offend the integrity and reputation of the legal profession. It's a very broad provision. So for that reason, I think it has potential to impact mediators much more than you might think. It also is relevant to solicitors acting for clients and the way they deal with other practitioners. Try to keep your negotiations courteous, even if the parties can't. So Rule 30 deals with honesty, and I think it goes without saying that most of you would be familiar with this rule, that practitioners can't engage in conduct, whether in the course of practice or otherwise, which is dishonest or calculated or likely to a material degree to be prejudicial to the administration of justice or diminish public confidence in the administration of justice or adversely prejudice a practitioner's ability to practice according to these rules. Again, it's a very broad provision which says that practitioners can't engage in dishonest conduct. This is particularly important for mediators because there are cases where mediators will be confronted with pleadings, for instance, which allege fraud, and they have to be very careful what admissions are made before them so that they're not seen to perpetuate a lie, so that they're not seen to be dishonest. The same will apply for practitioners where their clients may have had fraud alleged against them. If their client's instructing them to do something and the solicitor knows it's not in fact true or correct based on other material, what can the solicitor do? Can the solicitor simply be the mouthpiece for the client and put forward the instructions, or are they required to do something more than that and go further and not perpetuate the lie? And what Rule 30 is saying is, look, you must act honestly. You have that duty and you must do it. But the line sometimes is very hard to see. You may not have been told directly by your client, and probably sensibly you haven't asked whether what they're telling you is correct. So just be conscious of Rule 30, I guess, is the lesson out of that. Rule 9 deals with impartiality. Obviously, avoiding a conflict of interest where the practitioner's own interest is involved, that probably won't apply, but it may. A practitioner must not in any dealings with a client, and I emphasise the words with a client, because a mediator won't be dealing with a client in the sense that it is the mediator's client. The lawyers will be, however. So Rule 9, in one sense, probably may not apply to mediators, but there are other obligations which, if you like, mirror the impartiality. And certainly parties attending a mediation would expect that a mediator will act impartially, and it will be covered within the mediation agreement. It is one of the things, like confidentiality and neutrality, that parties will certainly expect when they attend a mediation. Clients will expect that a mediator is not going to favour one side or the other. But in the course of doing that, and I come back to the questions I asked at the start about fairness, does that mean that the mediator can never intervene one way or the other? And different people within the room will have different views about that. Some people will prefer an interventionist mediator who gets to the crunch of it and can put arguments to their clients about why their client might be wrong. On one view, perhaps that's not acting impartially. On the other hand, people would prefer it if the mediator just took a very central role and stayed entirely neutral. And I guess to some extent it will depend on the case that you are dealing with. The practice standard 5 says that mediators are required to disclose conflicts of interest before the start of the mediation process. And that is because you sometimes will have situations where a mediator has a conflict of interest. And if the mediator tells the parties right when they are engaging the mediator, it gives the parties the opportunity to engage an alternate mediator. It's not very useful for a mediator to be telling you on the day that everyone has gathered that, look, actually, I've got a conflict of interest. I actually did some work for one of these parties a long time ago, and I do recall something about this matter. That would not be helpful to resolution. So if you talk to some very good mediators, that is part of the reason they like to have often pre-mediation conferences, particularly in larger matters, where the parties can get together beforehand or at least put forward positions so the mediator can sort out whether or not there are conflicts of interest. So, confidential information if you are acting for or if you are the mediator. As I said before, Rule 3 of the Professional Conduct Rules is silent as to the mediator's obligation as to confidentiality. It talks about confidentiality where you are acting for a client. And it says that the confidential information of the client is to be kept confidential. So Rule 3 doesn't really help a mediator, and it doesn't really impose an obligation on a mediator. Practice Standard 6, however, says that a mediator must respect the confidentiality of parties, and there shouldn't be any form of voluntary disclosure. The mediator has a requirement to clarify what the parties expect at the start of the process, and this is usually done by the mediation agreement. And the mediation agreement itself will usually set out what the limits of confidentiality are.